Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Mystic Truth Radio. Today we have the third segment of our Alzheimer's, the Caregiver's Journey. And I am Elaine Reed Cole, and today we're going to do, this is a live show, so we're recording live, and we are going to be talking about everything that we've already talked about. We're going to kind of rehash segment one and segment two, and we're hoping that if you are available, that you can actually call in and join the conversation. And I am joined by my co-host, Dana Zimmerman. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Elaine. I'm glad to be here today, and this is a wonderful topic. So I am going to reiterate, people out there who are caregiving Alzheimer's patients or people who have questions, we would certainly love to hear from you because we have a couple of experts on our show today, a couple of really knowledgeable people about the Alzheimer's patient situation and the Alzheimer's caregiver situation, and it's a great opportunity for anybody out there to ask questions. We have a guest call-in number, and that is 914-219-0867, 914-219-0867. And when you get in to the show, you'll hear it on your phone. You're also prompted to press 1 to raise your hand, and that shows up on our board that we're monitoring here. And then we know to unmute you and engage with you and find out what you'd like to talk about. So hoping to hear from you and just glad to be here today.
Perfect. Now, also today joining us is someone who we actually did some of the pre-recorded shows with, and her name is Julie Fleming. And Julie Fleming, I have entitled you as the Alzheimer's advocate because truly that is what you are. So welcome once again, Julie, and we're happy to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with y'all, and I love that title. I would not have coined that for myself, but I take it with great pleasure.
Well, Julie, I must say that you are one of the people because, you know, I have talked to a few people, and some of them are not, you know, I didn't record with, and some I did record with, and you are one who takes action. And this is great. So can we go over just a little bit of your history in case someone is listening in and they actually didn't get around to being able to listen to the first two segments? So could you actually give people a little bit of prompting as to why you have become this Alzheimer's advocate?
Absolutely. The short version is that my father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2011. I had noticed some changes that concerned me, but that no one else noticed for probably 2 or 3 years before that. And so went through quite a bit of challenge getting him to the point of diagnosis. And then I have been his primary caregiver since that time, since he was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. There is no other family, so it has been just the two of us, and we're fortunate to have the help of some wonderful, wonderful paid caregivers. But through this process and through being his primary caregiver, I have learned so much about Alzheimer's. I've made so many mistakes and had so much angst that I really want to do whatever I can to help other caregivers out there avoid some of the pitfalls that I've fallen into, and also to raise awareness to help reduce the stigma that surrounds Alzheimer's so that people will talk about it, talk about what Alzheimer's really is. It's not just memory loss. Right. And ideally, hopefully, get us more funding for better treatment and a cure.
Couldn't have said that better myself. Mm-hmm. Now, the one part that, you know, I think our audience is probably curious about, because you say pitfalls. Now, I do want to say, honestly, when people out there, when you are trying your best, that's what you're doing. You're trying your best, whether it's right or wrong, whether you deem it right or wrong. Your best is your best. So, Julie, I'm sure you did no wrong, but if you want to maybe let people know what maybe some of the pitfalls, what it was, you know, where was some of what you deemed some of your stumbling blocks?
Sure. One big one really was lack of awareness of resources. So, mm-hmm. for instance, when we got to the point that one of the doctors told my father he could no longer drive, that was for probably 4 or 5 months, I did almost nothing but deal in one way or another with my father not driving.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, the conversation was first in January. It was not until June that I discovered that there are programs where you can take your loved one, they will do some testing actually in a lab that deals with spatial recognition, some memory understanding, things like that. Then they will actually take them out for a road test so that there is some kind of objective measurement of, can you drive, should you drive, or should you absolutely not drive? And it's difficult to say to someone, you can't drive. So finding that program made a huge difference to me. And how much better both of our lives would have been had we known back in January that such things were out there.
Right. Well, it would have put off that bickering back and forth, because here you are, you're the daughter. You know, it's really hard to be told these things by your child that you can't do something. It's the mm-hmm. role reversal. So if a non-related third party comes in and they say, you know, you really can't drive, they're more inclined to be able to try to accept that with some mm-hmm. great grace. No, so,
right.
Yeah, resources are really, really, really important. Now, did you happen to find that particular resource through the Alzheimer's Foundation, or how did you go about finding that?
I did not find it through the Alzheimer's Association. I actually did crazy amounts of online research, and it's kind of a funny story because my grandmother had also had Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
I tripped across the name of the doctor who had worked with her back in the 80s and mentioned in an article about him that I just started reading because it was interesting, was this clinic that he had started, and one part of what the clinic did was the driving test. So it could not possibly have been more of a roundabout way of finding that information. It never occurred to me that such a thing existed, so I didn't know to look for it.
Well, honestly, Julie, this is the first that I'm hearing of it. So
mm-hmm.
I think that it's really not out there very much.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It can't be, because I have not heard of this. So I'm just wondering if it's in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this readily available?
Readily available might be a stretch,
uh-huh.
But it is, I would say, in many, if not most, major metro areas, there's probably something.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have someone who's living in rural Texas, that's a lot tougher. I seriously doubt that kind of resource is available.
Right, right. So that was a major stumbling block for you. And yeah,
mm-hmm.
and now maybe just you saying this has helped yet one more person to avoid that, which is why we want to talk about this stuff, because honestly, just trying to make life God as easy as it can be in a very difficult situation. We're not overnight going to make the situation better. You know, we're still looking for a cure. We're still looking for a really good treatment because, you know, we don't have one of those yet. So basically, we're trying to make living conditions because, you know, not to coin a Monty Python saying, but, you know, we're not quite dead yet. So, you know, let's see if we can actually still get some laughter in there, get some enjoyment while you're still drawing a breath. It's nice to be able to have good times. Now, I know you've had quite a few really good times with your dad as you're going through this difficult time. And I think that you probably wouldn't necessarily change anything that you've set up in your life as far as, you know, keeping him at home and taking care of him. And, you know, you've opened up the doors to caregivers, you know, medical help. Actually kind of coming and going, so your privacy is not what it was before.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is, let's talk about where your dad's at now.
Mm.
Yeah.
So at this point, there, as you know, Elaine, there are a number of different models for the stages of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably the one that maybe most people hear about is a 7-stage model.
Right.
One is actually what we would call significant evidence of disease, although it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And stage 7, of course, is the worst or the most advanced. My father is in late stage 6, I would say, and I will say that with one asterisk. The models, of course, are set up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and they're very clear-cut. In real life, it doesn't
work
that way. No.
Right.
No. There's certain things in which my dad is in stage 7. There are others in which, on a regular basis, he is in stage 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And he can switch on a daily basis or sometimes even an hourly basis.
Right.
So for anyone who pulls up this model and says, well, none of these are exactly right, yeah. Yeah, I think that is the common experience.
Mm-hmm. I think it's good to have the model, though, so that people can take a look and they're not blindsided
mm-hmm.
by, you know, now today everything is different. Because now they would have read about it and they go, oh, all right, now I know that might happen. So, you know, it takes away that the shock value some so that you're equipped to be able to handle it. Now, you actually talked about a book during our previous interview, so would you actually bring that up again, the Bible for Alzheimer's?
Oh, the Bible. Yes, okay. Thank you. I was hoping you would give me a hint. The book that we had talked about before is The 36-Hour Day, which mm-hmm. is the Bible for Alzheimer's. It is a fantastic, extensive, detailed book about everything that might happen. And I use it as a reference book. So when something
yep.
comes up, that's where I go. When my dad was first diagnosed, actually he was diagnosed, I don't remember the day of the week, but the next day we actually got on a plane to take a vacation. And so I had my Kindle with me and a bunch of books, and I knew about the 36-hour day because of my grandmother's experience, and sat down and started reading it. And before when I was not very far in, I concluded that if I continued to read this book, I would be so depressed that I would be unable to function because
mm-hmm.
of just this litany of this awful thing happens and then this awful thing and this awful thing. And the truth is, there's a saying about Alzheimer's, when you have met one person with Alzheimer's, you've met one person with Alzheimer's.
That's right.
Nobody, I imagine, very few people, let's put it that way, will have every single thing that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, reading this long list and anticipating all of the things that might happen was too much. But using this book as a resource has been absolutely invaluable, because whenever something comes up, I guarantee you it is covered somewhere in that book.
Yeah, so I suggest for people who are dealing with this or finding themselves as caregivers now to pick this book up. And again, don't keep it on your nightstand, because you don't want to read this as you're going to bed at night. But to have it around, it's a reference, and it's a very good reference. So, yeah, just don't get inundated by the whole thing of it. Now, I love the fact that you brought up that people are an individual, and I find that is so said to be true, which is why you can't be guaranteed that somebody's going to be nasty. You can't be guaranteed that somebody's going to be happy. You can't be guaranteed that it is strictly Alzheimer's that they have. And that kind of leads us into a little bit of crossover diseases that can happen. Now, during our first interview, we touched a little bit on some of the physical symptoms that quite often an Alzheimer's patient might be displaying, like macular degeneration and rheumatoid arthritis and stuff like that. But we didn't actually touch on things like Lewy bodies dementia, which is something that our audience may have heard of it just because of Robin Williams having just, you know, he was diagnosed with it postmortem. And the symptoms that he was going through. So Lewy bodies is the second leading dementia after Alzheimer's. But quite often, it doesn't get diagnosed. The person may actually get diagnosed as being psychotic or schizophrenic. They may be put on drugs that are meant for someone who, you know, has one of those kind of disabilities, mental disabilities. And honestly, if they are put on an antipsychotic, it can actually make the Lewy body's dementia worse. So you can actually have Alzheimer's and Lewy bodies at the same time. So they will start displaying some different symptoms because of the Lewy bodies, which is the Lewy body itself is another protein, but it's not the same kind of like tau protein that you find in Alzheimer's. It's different. They coined it Lewy body protein. And generally, you find it on the cortex of the brain. So the symptoms that come along with that can couple in with the Alzheimer's symptoms. So certainly there may be memory loss, but not absolutely with someone who has Lewy bodies will they have. That is their predominant thing. They generally will always be displaying some type of hallucination. They may think that they're in a room full of people partying. Okay, fine. Well, you know what? Honestly, if they are surrounded by happy, partying people, there's no harm in that. You know, that is all good. Of course, if they are hallucinating that they are surrounded by groups of people who are, you know, walking zombies and out to kill them, well, that's a walking nightmare, and that's another, you know, different kind of situation. So these kinds of hallucinations can vary extremely, and a lot just is dependent upon, you know, their emotional reaction to what they are seeing. They also can look at something and interpret it as something else. So a pillow on the couch may become a dog on the couch. And to them, it truly, truly is a dog. that's exactly what they see. They want to go over. They want to pet the dog. All of a sudden, that dog, which is actually a pillow, is licking them. And they believe this. Now, on top of that, they may have delusions. So they may believe that their spouse, if they are recognizing who their spouse is that their spouse is having an affair. And they are absolutely positive that that spouse is having an affair, period. That's it. And there may be no basis for that thought process at all. There's nothing to base that fact on. But for them, it is a fact. Or, as in the case with Anne, who was actually one that we interviewed, her husband would look at her and call her his girlfriend because, you know, he wanted to actually, you know, he didn't know what happened to his wife. So he would be looking right at her, and of course this is his wife, and be saying, this is my girlfriend here, and now I don't know what happened to that other lady, but I want to marry you. So they actually went through their anniversary, and for her it was an anniversary, but they actually had another, like, renewal of vows, but for him it was the first time. So, you know, he thought it was the first time, so now they got married. So now he's married to his / girlfriend, who is actually his wife. So, you know, it's kind of a weird thing. Lewy body also is coupled right in with Parkinson's, so it can display itself with that rigid kind of gait type thing that happens in Parkinson's. Generally, anybody who has Lewy body will actually display Parkinson's disease too, so it's really coupled in there. So you may have somebody who has Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lewy bodies all clumped right in together. Now, that can also make it fairly dangerous because during REM sleep, REM sleep, your body generally shuts down during that time. You know, it has this automatic paralysis to it, so you're not acting out your dreams. But with somebody who has Lewy bodies, that mechanism isn't working. So they actually begin to act out and slash out during their REM sleep. So sleep becomes almost dangerous, like if they're sharing the bed with somebody else, or it can be a danger for themselves getting up and moving or trying something. And, you know, they're asleep, but they're still moving. So, you know, has anybody actually come up with any of that, talking about that at all on the ACM exchange at all, Julie?
I don't believe anyone has spoken specifically about Lewy body. I don't remember it at this moment anyway. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting, though, and I'm glad you're stressing the importance of getting a diagnosis or a as good a diagnosis as possible while someone is living. Mm-hmm. The numbers of people who have Alzheimer's but are undiagnosed are enormous. I don't have the stats at my fingertips, but I want to say it's something like 50%. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is the number of people who have Lewy body undiagnosed is very significant as well.
Yep.
And it matters not only for the reasons that you're mentioning, but there are other kinds of dementia. So, for instance, my father also has vascular dementia. Mm-hmm. And the progressions of each disease are different. The treatments for each disease may be different. The symptoms of each disease are different. And as a caregiver, for instance, with Alzheimer's, there's typically a fairly long, slow, consistent decline, at least for later onset Alzheimer's. But my father had these huge stair steps down, which was very confusing to me until I discovered that that is characteristic of vascular dementia, which he had. So it helps to understand what may happen. It
right.
helps to make sense of, is this what the kind of progression we would expect to see, or is there a major problem here that I need to get investigated? So it can be difficult to get a good diagnosis, but I would really encourage people to work to go see a neuropsychiatrist as well as a neurologist to get a clear diagnosis, because it actually does matter.
It does matter. The only thing is that physicians really don't even know exactly how to diagnose it until postmortem, when
mm-hmm.
they can do an autopsy on the brain, and then they can actually take a look at the protein deposits and where they are located within the brain and what is making up that particular protein. So, you know, obviously, you don't want your loved one or patient to go through brain biopsies or anything like that. That's totally devastating, too. So truly, it is up to the caregiver to write down when something weird happens. And, you know, you might see it displayed a few times. You know, if they're, let's use the pillow on the couch thing. If they are, you know, sitting over by that pillow on the couch and they continually talk to it and pet it, well, that's important to tell the doctor. It may not seem like it at the moment, but it is. So you have to keep a journal and write it down, because that's going to help the physician to adjust their medications for, you know, whatever it is. They need help in that living person diagnosis, and that's tough. Now, we had brought up in our private conversations, too, over Facebook and stuff, we had brought up Huntington's disease, which is also something that, you know, it's a degenerative brain disorder, which Huntington's, you know, most people have heard of it. They're not quite sure what that's all about, but it's a genetic factor. You know, it's passed down through your genes. However, it doesn't mean that your grandmother, who actually died of Huntington's, was diagnosed with Huntington's. And it's very possible that, you know, your parents, who are elderly now, have maybe not displayed any of the symptoms of it until now. And now here you are, and maybe you're in your, you know, early to mid-30s, and you're just finding out that your 70-year-old dad has Huntington's. And it's because his mother had Huntington's, and uh-oh, and it wasn't diagnosed, and now you've got this hanging over your head. So this is one case where they have actually developed being able to test for it. It's genetic testing. So within your DNA strand, usually I heard somebody explain it like this. They said, you know, your DNA goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You know, it's kind of right in order, and that is fine. But in Huntington's, it'll go A, B, C, D, 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 D. And so, you know, the end of that DNA trail just kind of repeats and repeats and repeats. And depending upon how many D's there are, really kind of gives an indication of when you will start to display the disease itself. So Huntington's is another thing. You know, it's a physical kind of thing. It may not hit the dementia part of it until a bit later. Or the dementia part of it might be the first part that displays their body. They may just kind of like start falling down, you know, balances off, all that. And again, once again, we're talking about things that make it so that the neuroreceptors in your brains are not, it's not working. And then the dementia part of it comes up. Well, how frightening is that? However, there is hope within that disease because they're actually finding that within mice, and it's so sad that they use mice, but I guess they have to use something. They have found a drug that has actually been able to work on those protein deposits within the brain and start breaking them down. Now, that's good. Now, also, say you're, you know, that person who the parent is in their 70s and you're in your early 30s, and you found out that your parent has that, you can go and you can get your makeup tested to see if you are carrying the Huntington's disease. Now, if you are carrying the Huntington's disease, there isn't hope yet for you. There isn't a cure there for you. But say you got married when you were 28 and now you're 31 and you and your spouse, you wanted to have children. And you know that there is a 50-50 chance that they are going to get the Huntington's gene passed to them too. Which is, you know, that's a sword of Damocles just hanging over your head. How horrible is it when, you know what the progression of this disease is going to look like and you're going to pass that on. So what they have actually been able to do is for that couple who have not had children yet but want to have children but do not want to pass that gene along, they can actually fertilize their sperm, egg, and then test those embryos to see if the embryos carry the gene defect or not. And then they can take the ones that are not affected, because they will not all be cookie cutter, yeah, you all got them. It's kind of a Russian roulette type thing. So there was one couple that I listened to their interview, and they actually had, I think it was four embryos, and two of them did not have the gene. They were clear. So they implanted those two embryos, and they have two healthy boys now. Even though the husband is, eventually this will do him in, although he's working in the research to try to find the cure. So he's very, very diligent about it. You know, he's scientifically involved in it. But he can go through this journey with his wife knowing that they have not passed that gene along. Now, that's something that it would be so nice if we can actually work on that more and more for all of these dementias that we're talking about, so that we can actually make it so that, you know, this abnormality with the proteins in the brain doesn't happen anymore. So I don't know if you've heard of any advances at all in that area with Alzheimer's at all, Julie, but, that's certainly something that I pray for.
Absolutely. There are a lot of people working on it, and the thing that I find so interesting, I have a Google search saved that looks for Alzheimer's treatments, and there are so many promising threads, I'll call them. Uh-huh. But it seems to me that more often than not, when I get something, it is an announcement of a drug that failed somewhere in the course of the clinical trials. Uh-huh. And one of the problems that we have is that the funding for Alzheimer's is so tiny in comparison to federal funding for other kinds of disease research, and certainly in comparison to the number of people who are affected with Alzheimer's and other dementias now, and even more so as that's going to grow as baby boomers age. So that's one reason why it's so important to talk about Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And to there are no survivors. That's one of the problems. No one can stand up and say, I survived Alzheimer's.
Right.
And so they're none of the feel-good stories. It's not, it sounds silly to say, it's not a happy, graceful way to die. And so there is a stigma. There is a desire to protect dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those, it's important to protect dignity. I, despite speaking out about what's going on with my dad and sharing some of his stories, I will go to the ends of the earth to protect his dignity. Part of protecting his dignity, though, is recognizing that there is something even more important, and that is sharing what this is all about and getting some attention so that we can get funding so other people will not have to deal with this.
Bravo. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I just, in my gut, there is something that tells me that there's something simple out there that is being overlooked. Just something simple. What
is
it? You know, something that I know, and it's such a complicated thing, but something in my gut just says, you know, there's something that we are exposed to over and over and over again. You know, now it resides within all human beings, and it is triggering off. Just like years ago, and Dana will probably jump in on this one, but all of us carry a certain amount of Teflon in our body. As a human race, we were so exposed to Teflon that you can find traces of Teflon within every single human body. Really? Wow, I didn't know that. I don't remember chewing on a frying pan. But, you know, somehow, because of the way of the world and how it is, we all have traces of Teflon. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely, Elaine. And you know, growing up as baby boomers, Teflon was a huge addition to everyone's kitchen, right? Everybody had to have the new Teflon pan because of the whole nonstick thing. You know, we were cooking out of things where, you know, you had to scrub your pan. Now you had this new innovation, Teflon. But, you know, it wasn't thoroughly tested as to how long-term the chemicals in that Teflon were going to affect human beings.
Right.
And
that's
true of so many of the innovations that came out in the 60s and 70s, and they're still coming out. They get FDA approved way before there's any kind of idea of how it affects human beings long term.
Sure.
And, you know, so we're exposed to so many toxins. And
yeah, we are. I mean, that whole Teflon thing went into our clothing, it went into our rugs, it went on to our furniture. I mean, it was used for everything because, you know, it was a stain guard. So,
right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. All those treatments for rugs and furnitures and infants' clothing that are fire resistant. I mean, you know, all those chemicals that go onto everything that, you know, we're wearing and we have around our house and that have been introduced into the food supply. You know, Julie talked on the last show about, you know, the different books identifying different, you know, things that contribute to the Alzheimer's thing, and she mentioned the one about, I guess there was a book that said that not eating grain was helpful for the Alzheimer's patient. But not eating grain these days is helpful for anybody with any kind of disorder.
That's right.
It's not the grain itself. Well, it could be the grain itself. It's what's happened in bringing the grain to the table to make it easy for the people who produce it. So pesticides, herbicides, hybridization to make it a more sturdy grain. You know, everything that's involved, fungicides, everything that's involved in putting that grain on the table is putting more toxins into it. And it's probably not so much the grain itself. It's what's being slathered onto it before it gets to your table. And
that's
all
right.
those things, all those toxins just add to the inflammatory load in the body.
Right.
So many diseases that are manifesting, Alzheimer's being one of them, have a huge inflammatory component.
That's right. That's right. Now, Julie, there was a discussion, so we won't name names or anything like that, but that somebody had brought up that their mother was eating sweets left and right, kind of. That's all she wanted was sweets. And, of course, the mother has Alzheimer's. So, you know, that really kind of triggered off in me. The fact that that should probably be addressed a little bit more because, you know, it was brought up, okay, well, so long the person isn't diabetic and all that. But I think instinctually they are going for that sugar because sugar can be numbing. So instinctually it can separate them from any part of their, as far as being conscious, of what's going on with them. So, Dana, could you actually talk a little bit about what sugar does within the brain?
Sure, Elaine. Thanks. And, you know, I think sugar can be numbing, but I
mm-hmm.
think also if a brain is not functioning properly and not getting the right levels of the fuel it needs, sometimes that burst of sugar could also be giving an Alzheimer's patient a degree of clarity.
Yep.
But glucose, actual sugar, isn't really what the brain is fueled by. And the brain is such an enigma. There is so much that we don't know about it. You know, I was reading an article from Dr. Mercola where they were actually calling Alzheimer's like type 3 diabetes because of the whole sugar dysfunction and insulin dysfunction
Ooh.
That's on in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sugar is so inflammatory as well, especially the sugar we're getting on our table these days because it doesn't most of the time actually come from actual cane sugar. It comes from sugar beets, which are grown, genetically modified and grown under the same conditions I was talking about with the grains.
Right.
So, you know, there's so much going on with the brain that we don't know about it. And I thought it was so interesting. You can Google it where Dr. Mercola talks about, you know, they were almost dubbing Alzheimer's tentatively. This is like in the mid-2000s. Type 3 diabetes.
Wow. Okay. You know what,
though?
That makes sense
to me. Insulin produced by the brain.
Mm-hmm. That
yeah.
makes sense. So,
mm-hmm.
and yes, we do know about, you know, everybody hears about how good beets are for you. Beets are great. You know, they're, one of these superfoods. I can't stress enough. Only if they are organic.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they are one of the most dirty foods that you can possibly be eating. So, you know, don't eat them if it doesn't say organic.
Absolutely,
stress.
And that's
stress,
true of
stress.
So many foods out there.
Mm-hmm.
So very true of so many foods out there.
Mm-hmm. So as far as the person eating sweets, what I would do is actually monitor how they are afterwards. If they are an agitated person, you know, if they are hyper and kind of agitated and all that, and then they eat some sweets and all of a sudden they're calmer, great. If they are in that kind of catatonic type state, and they want to eat some sugar, and then, you know, all of a sudden they eat it, and now they're looking at you, they're kind of interacting some, then great. But I would watch for a response and see how it's actually acting with them and acting with their particular brain chemistry. And, you know, it's everything in moderation, too. But, again...
Yeah, that's good advice, although at the same point, you know, sugar is very misunderstood. And the one thing that people don't understand about it, I think, is that it is a highly addictive substance.
Mm-hmm.
So once mom starts eating sweets, she probably wants to keep eating them because her body will decide that more and more sweets are what it needs.
I
remember my grandmother, when she was living with my parents before she died, had to have my dad go out and get her box of donuts every day.
Oh my God,
and she had to have the really sugary one with the icings and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would go up to her bedroom and she would have donuts folded in napkins in, like, every drawer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She was addicted to that sugar. She needed that sugar. Whatever it was giving her, whether it was calming or numbing, or whether it was just now an addiction that could not be broken, because if you look at the world today and the amount of sugar in things, it's crazy.
Right.
You know, I mean, the best thing you can do if somebody's eating sugar, because sugar is not the best idea for an Alzheimer's patient, it's also inflammatory.
Right.
And it's not the right kind of fuel for the brain, is at least try and get them foods with pure cane sugar in it or organic cane sugar in it. At least you're giving them some kind of healthy or sweet if they're going to have their sugar.
Go for things like, you know, the things that are sweet but aren't sugar at all, you know, pure maple syrup, agave.
Raw honey.
You know, there's... honey, and
lean
towards that and try to crave that sweet tooth. And there are positive properties to each one of those. So, you know, honey is a huge antiviral substance. So, you know, a nice little honey cake, you know, that I think that could actually be good for them and maybe steer away from the Hostess Twinkies. You know, so it means a little bit more cooking maybe on your part, or finding an organic bakery who will actually tell you what is in it. But, you know, as far as that goes, you want them to find pleasure in any eating that they're doing, because quite often they will stop eating unless you have it, like, right there prepared in front of them. That is something that, you know, I talking to people over and over again, they can't be left to their own devices because they will not eat. You know, it's like that part of their brain that triggers off, I am hungry, is shut down. But the part where the food is in front of them and it becomes an automatic response to eat what is in front of them, you know, the hand to mouth, if they're still capable of doing that. And, you know, if they're enjoying what they're putting in their mouth, well, God, that's a little enjoyment. Great. You know, you try to find these small victories wherever you can. Now, Julie, do you find
I just want to add there, well, Elaine, you're right. And, you know, it's all about balance and moderation. You know, if someone's got a disease and taking something away is going to make them agitated or, you know, make their life worse and decrease their quality of life, you know, that's when you just, as a caregiver, have to make the decision that, you know, it's okay to let them have that piece of happiness.
Oh, yeah. Well, Carla, who we interviewed, the caregiver, Carla, who, you know, did it professionally for different people and the old women that she was taking care of, and they drank their wine. That was it. They're in their 80s and their 90s, and they would have wine with every meal. I mean, you know.
Exactly,
so.
Yeah. But like Carla said, they drank their wine, and, of course, alcohol can make people more confused. But you know what? You're not going to take that away from them. It's what,
That's right.
They were used to doing. It was part of a routine for them. You know, to break that routine would be more difficult than anything else.
That's right. So, Julie, does your dad still consume food or not?
He does. He actually has a phenomenal appetite.
That's great.
It is good. One of the things, though, that happens as you get toward end stage with this disease, and really with any disease, I would guesstimate that he is taking in somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 calories a day.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he has been losing weight just really steadily for months now.
Mm-hmm.
And at the last time that he was he's in hospice, so the last time he was recertified for hospice, one of the measurements that they do is to measure the arm and see if there's weight loss. The nurse practitioner said, well, this doesn't show that his arm has shrunk, but I think that's because there's no more shrinking to be done.
Oh.
So I want to prepare people. I'm sort of chuckling as y'all are talking about sugar because a few weeks ago I was at a conference and had dinner with a friend of mine, and I decided I would take some dessert home to my dad because I do try to get him as many calories as I can.
As possible, yeah.
And so we were at this restaurant, and the waitress came over and said, would you like dessert? I said, well, I'd like to take some home. Tell me, what is the biggest, highest calorie, most fattening thing you have on your dessert menu? And you should have seen her eyes. So I definitely believe in good nutrition. We work hard to both give my dad real foods and to supplement with things like I do homemade nutritional shakes.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to add in the things that are high calorie and pure pleasure for him.
Yep.
And at this point in the disease, honestly, for me, if he wanted to eat only bread pudding or rice pudding or whatever,
I would
certainly keep offering him other things. But if that's what he wanted and he didn't want other things, great.
Yeah.
Let him have it.
Yeah. Well, as you stated, he's in hospice.
Mm-hmm.
So you are closing in. You know, if you had to give it a number, like you tried it, you know, it's 6 or 7. You know, it's somewhere foggy in there. And unfortunately, usually towards those ends, they start to lose the swallowing reflex also. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, let him enjoy whatever he can for right now. Now, I'm so glad that you actually talked about you going out. Because you went out. You went out.
I went out.
Did.
Woo, party!
You went out. So let's stress how important it is for you to have a life. And here we are, for anybody who is listening to this at a later date, it's the day before Thanksgiving. So let's talk a little bit about the holidays and going out and how you cope and deal with that. So how are things looking for you, Julie?
So for me, the most important thing is to be very clear about expectations. Last year, my dad was in a very different place, and we had a traditional Thanksgiving dinner. He sat at the table. We had conversation, all of those more traditional things. Now, the conversation was not typical, but it was still conversation.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
This year, he is in a very different place. He will not sit for a meal. He cannot have conversation. He may talk, and we have the rhythm of conversation, but it's a very different thing, and honestly, very few people can really do the kind of carrying on with him that I do, just because he and I are so accustomed to our rhythms.
Right.
And so instead of having the Norman Rockwell Thanksgiving, which I love, Thanksgiving is family and one of my favorite holidays, I am having food that is Thanksgiving food. It will be cooked and it will be ready. And we will all have little plates here and there when we feel like it. It won't be a capital T Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
But we will be together. I will
be
grateful for everything that I can be grateful for.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to set us up with expecting or even hoping for things that aren't going to happen.
Good girl.
I've been down that road. It did not work.
Yep. So expectations, very difficult. And, you know, I do believe in miracles, but for a day to think that that is going to be the miraculous day when everything will be normal. What is normal? Let's define that. Let's, you know, because it's not. So take those expectations away. It is what it is. It's that facing of that really hard to face reality. But, you know, this might sound callous, but it's not meant to be, is that we are all dying, period. You know, we are all, everybody, if you're listening to this, you're not ruled out. We are all dying. So you right now, Julie, have the opportunity to be with your dad, even though a lot of your dad as you knew him is no longer within his body. But the dad that you always knew still there.
Mm-hmm.
He's still there. He's just in a different place. He's in a different vibration. You can talk to him differently. Now, something that I have experienced, because, you know, I've dealt with people in their dying process, I've dealt with people who have been comatose, and I've dealt with people with Alzheimer's too. So they begin to reach a certain point when they are less in their body. So they're more heading into that catatonic type state. And they, for me, and we can all do this if we wrap our heads around it, for me, it's easier to talk to them then than when they were in their body in an agitated state or that confused state. They hit a point where they pass that. So they have more than just one foot on the other side. They're starting to pick that last foot up, and it's starting to cross over. So for an instance, a good friend of mine, I knew her really most of my whole life, an older woman who people have heard me talk about her on the show before, and she is the one who taught me how to howl at the moon. So again, I knew her throughout my whole life. And she had Alzheimer's. And towards her end stages, she was in a facility being cared for. And a friend of mine would drive me over there so that I could actually see her. And at one point, I was so distressed because she was in her body and she was still trying to communicate, but it was kind of babbling communicating. And I could just feel her. She was upset. You know, she actually said something about not wanting to make the pretty girl cry. So she was, you know, talking about me because I had tears in my eyes and it was a horrible place to see this beautiful woman at. Now, one of the last times that I saw her was just before she passed. And one would have thought that to the physical eye, it could have been more distressing. But she had separated enough from her body that she was no longer in it. And the thing that I kept hearing her say over and over again was one of her son's names. Like, she was distressed about that one son. But mostly, she was okay. She was okay. There was a peacefulness about her, except for bringing up that one son's name. And I'm like, well, that's kind of crazy. And I told my friend, because she had come in with me, and I'm like, she keeps saying, and I'm not going to say his name just in case they're listening, but she keeps saying this son's name, and she's really wondering where he is. Where is he? Where is he? So fast forward a little bit, you know, she passed and I went to the funeral, and, you know, family members are all there and stuff. And one of the other brothers came up to me and he said, yeah, you know, everybody's here except we couldn't find, and he said that brother's name. And he never came to the funeral, and he didn't show up. And I just thought, you know what? She's at peace now. She knows where he is. She's crossed to the other side. But that was her thoughts at the very end, was of this one particular son. Like, no matter what, your loved ones are going to try to always make sure that you're okay. And that's what your dad will still want, as he starts to separate from being this person who is carrying this disease within his physical body. As he begins to detach more and more, his thoughts will be about you and are you okay?
Mm-hmm. So, and I think one of... Oh, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead, please.
I think one of the most important things that we can do, and also one of the hardest, is to let our loved ones know that we're okay and we will be okay. And they will be missed and we will be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's important for all the caregivers out there to start taking care of yourself now. Because, of course, when people cross to the other side, they don't go very far. They don't go far at all. So are they going to want to see you in distress for the rest of your life because you're thinking about them? Well, no. They're going to want you to be happy and to carry on and to make the most out of your life. So to fill in your life now with the things that still bring you happiness and bring you joy. Your red nail polish there, Julie, that you brought up when we in the last segment. You know, and I thought about that, and I'm like, you know, that's a great reminder. It's right there. You know, you're holding the pen, and it's right there. Of course, you brought up, too, you went out. Good for you. You have to still live. It's important.
You know, it is, and it's interesting. A friend of mine, I have a very good friend who is a shaman, and she called me one day and said, I had a dream about your dad. And this was back in late winter, early spring, when he had, as you were putting it, Elaine, a foot in each world, and he was starting to lift up the other foot.
Yep.
And so I said, oh, well, what was your dream? And she said, he came to me, and he said, tell her to live her life.
Yeah.
And it is so hard to do. It is so hard. But one thing that I have learned through this is not only the importance for them, for us, all of those things, but also to ask, what is underneath the way that I am living if I am not living my life? Because for me, I discovered, for instance, it is not important to me necessarily that I be physically with my father when he dies.
Mm-hmm.
I know he does not want that for me. It is important that I be here in Atlanta with him and that I be close and frankly, that I be in the house if I can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered at one point when I was not going out, when I had pretty much, I've done it always, seriously, when I had really stopped doing everything other than caring for him and worrying about him. And after I had that conversation with my friend, I realized that part of what I was doing, part of it was certainly for him, but part of it was for me trying to control, as ridiculous as it sounds, when he might die and where I would be when he does.
Yep. Yep. And that does not sound crazy at all, because you are not alone in that boat. You try to rationalize the irrational, and you can't.
Right.
You can give it a good try, but you can't. So long you know that you've got no control over this, then you will be okay. You've got no control. It is not, it's not up to you.
Mm-hmm.
It is up to you to make sure that things are in place as much as they can be. And that's the best that you can do with it, is to try to just make sure that you've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and put everything in place as much as you can. And that is one thing with all the diseases that we're talking about, because it's not an overnight death, although sometimes we would wish that it was, but it's not an overnight kind of thing, which does actually give the caretaker and people who are going to survive it time to get things in order. So, you know, you're not blindsided by, you know, ridiculous medical bills and stuff like that. There are ways that you can try to work your way around it. Not that it's not an expensive disease, but it really can be. So you have to seek out things that we actually brought up before, Julie, as far as like elder law goes. That's important. Don't be blindsided by anything. We do live in a day and age where the internet is our friend. So, you know, that's how you found out about the driving part of it. And you have set up a website so that people can talk about these things. I want people to come out of the closet on this. Come out of the closet and let's talk about it. We have an awful lot of people who, you know, they're going to go through this for 10, 15 years, sometimes more, but, you know, around that amount of time. And they need help, and they need a voice. And to keep it all to yourself and to keep it all shut up doesn't help anybody. It helps nobody. It's like hiding it. It's like, you know, a dirty little secret. It's like the donuts wrapped in the napkin, you know. It's hidden. And we really have to bring it out into the light so that we can find things more and more. It's funny you brought up your shaman friend. So I'm a shaman also. And what I found is that before he was diagnosed, one person that I know quite well, I kept having dreams with him in it. I didn't know why. He wasn't diagnosed. So I would talk to his daughter and say, geez, you know, is your stepdad okay? Oh, yeah, he's fine. And I'm like, geez, I had a dream with him in it. And it's not like I saw him day in, day out. I didn't. But what was happening is that his consciousness would travel more. It traveled more as he was beginning this process of, you know, the plaques and tangles forming in his brain. He was traveling more, and he was seeking out whatever could anchor him back down again. So he would pop into my dreams. And it was, so I could pinpoint around when he was finally diagnosed, when the process started with him. And I was pretty much on the money with it, is that, you know, it was a couple of years down the road that he got the diagnosis. And he had started astral traveling, we'll call it, or getting caught in his own plaques and tangles out in the astral plane prior to that. That is in the area, though, where you want to start talking to and conversing with the people who they can't enter energetically so much back into their body anymore. So that energy, again, it doesn't go away. It just shifts and changes where it's going to reside. So you'll find that too, Julie, and what I want you to do is not doubt, like don't say, oh, that was just my imagination that my dad was thinking this or my dad was saying that. And you said you have your own rhythm with him, so I want you to trust in that and move into that kind of communication so that you're still communicating with him on some level.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good point. We tend to take communication to be verbal communication.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't. One of the wonderful things about my dad that remains is he's always had a great sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
He can't tell jokes now, and he can't make puns. He can't do the things he used to do. But every now and again, I will look up at him, and he will widen his eyes, and he'll get this funny look on his face, and he's making me laugh. He's communicating. In that moment,
yes.
We're communicating.
Yes.
And one of the things that I think is so dangerous for us as caregivers is it's possible to focus so much on the caregiving and making sure that he has what he needs and I've done everything that I need to do. And as you said, all my T's are crossed and my I's are dotted, or on some days all my T's are dotted and I's are crossed. And to
yeah.
miss those seconds, they're not even moments, they're seconds.
Yep.
And
yep.
to me, being present is the very most important thing that I can do.
Yep. Yeah.
That kind of connection you cannot break.
That's right. That's right. And to know when he does cross over, because you know that that's the end game, is that he's not going to go very far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Julie, I would like to thank you once again for your amazing input and for all the work that you are doing for everybody out there. I know we didn't record it last time because you and I were actually talking, but I had asked you, you know, what you will do when your dad does pass, because, you know, he's on hospice and you know this is going to happen. And what would you do? And you said, I will work harder. I will try even harder. And I want people to hear that. I'll get louder. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's important. You know, this isn't just about your dad. This is about so many people out there. And it's not just about medicine. I want to stress that to people. It's not just about medicine. This is about humanity and how kind can we be to each other. You know, what can we do to help each other out? So I think that's important too. So I want to thank you again. And if people want to reach out to you, Julie, and kind of hop on your bandwagon, then you have a website, right? So could you share that website with people?
Sure. The website is alzheimerscaregiverminute.com.
Okay. And you're on Facebook. So how can they find you on Facebook?
I have a page that is, again, Alzheimer's Caregiver Minute. And we also have a group that is the ACM Exchange, which you can find on facebook.com/groups/ Alzheimer's Caregiver Minute Exchange.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, if you want to make sure that you are not alone, then this is yet another resource to take away that loneliness. And Dana, do you have anything else that you would like to ask or share with Julie before we close out?
I just like to express my appreciation to Julie for being on these shows and sharing everything she has to share. I think it's an incredibly important subject. And just to remind everybody out there that if this is the first time they're listening to the show, this is the third of three segments of shows that we put together in the past 3 weeks, all on the caregiver's journey. So, and it's all recorded on Blog Talk Radio. You find Mystic Truth Radio, and you can go back and listen to any of these recordings over and over again. So Whether this is just starting to affect you or it's something that you might come across in the future, this information is here for a reference. Julie is there to connect with as her, as the Alzheimer's advocate, as Elaine has named her, and we love that. And so I'm just hoping that everybody who connects with this material is able to get some help with it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. My name is Dana Zimmerman, and you can find me on Facebook as Dana Zimmerman or at my website, which is www.danazimmerman.com, or my coaching website where I coach highly sensitive people, and many highly sensitive people are natural caregivers, so that might be something that any caregivers listening here might want to look into, and that website is www.danazimmerman.info.com, or I'm sorry, .info, there's no .com, it's danazimmerman.info, I-N-F-O.
Perfect.
And Elaine?
All right, and I'm Elaine Reed Cole. You can also find me on Facebook. I do jump onto the ECM Exchange every now and then, and I will probably continue to do that too, Julie. Thank you
very much.
And you can also go on to my Facebook page. It's Elaine Reed Cole, The Winged Mystic. And you can go onto my website, www.thewingedmystic.com. And also, you can like us on Facebook, Mystic Truth Radio. You know, we cover so many different topics. And Dana and I are both coaches who can help you through any kind of stress in your life or whatever might be going on. You know, we like to try to tackle that on. So you can find us there. You can also go on to our website, which we have in mutual, which is www.mystictruth.net. And thank you, everybody. And I want to say happy Thanksgiving. You know, as Julie had brought up, be present, be thankful, moment by moment. So, all right. Bye, everybody. And until next time, let's keep talking about it. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.